From my perspective, where do I start here? When I was a postdoc at Cornell, Leonard Jossem was his name, had a paper recently in Physics Today within the last year, not on this, but on something else. He was a guy who did X-ray diffraction, and he desperately wanted to use the Cambridge Electron Accelerator, the synchrotron radiation from that, and they wouldn't do it. CEA didn't allow anybody to use synchrotron radiation until they basically had been shut down, which is the way things went.
Huh.
Yeah, this, you know, this is the history. And I remember talking to Lenny about it. He was so unhappy because he knew this thing was sitting there making these intense X-rays that he could use. And anyway, that happened. And when we built the Mira machine, the 50 MeV machine, the final thing that determined the lifetime of the beam was synchrotron anti-damping of the betatron oscillations, the radial betatron oscillations. And actually, George Parsons worked that out. He got the formula for that, and it fit pretty well. And everything else, but you know, also the momentum spread was damping very sharply. So you just watch the apparent beam intensity increase. You've probably seen that movie. Ed McMillan was quite impressed by that. Anyway, so synchrotron radiation was there. When I went to Saclay in 61, the first thing we worked on was a proton machine, but then they couldn't get money for it, and Orsay got interested in building an E plus E minus collider. Nobody at that time knew how to build a lattice that was stable under synchrotron radiation. And while I was there, I solved that problem. And at the same time, Claudio Pellegrini solved that problem at Frascati. Mm-hmm. We both published, so most of those papers are out there. And when I went back to Mura, my goal was to build not a synchrotron light source, but an electron or a storage ring. Because really, the only thing that had been built before then was by Andrei Budker at Novosibirsk. And that was just a weak focusing machine. And so I wanted to test this method of using strong focusing for a storage ring. And when the Mira proposal was turned down, we had a lot of talks out there. The people who worked there went on for quite a while. And we discussed, and this storage ring got raised again. And it was at least apparent to me that there was interesting accelerator physics to be done, but as a secondary use, if it so developed, it would be good for synchrotron radiation. So I pushed that very hard. A lot of people jumped on, like Ed and Charlie and Bill Winter and so on. And Keith was busy with plasmas then. But so it sort of became the lab's thing to do with that storage ring. And we were very fortunate because a former professor from Wisconsin was the associate director of Argonne at that time, and we were switched to being funded through Argonne. That's when I was director of the lab, and he tolerated us building that ring without a proposal. There was never a proposal. You'll never find a proposal.
No.
Other than if you ever find some of my old letters from Argonne back and forth in that period, you'll find it in there. But that's the only place you'll find it. So we used part of the phase-out money. Well, you used it for two or three things. This is all said. All these things are said in this book, most of them anyway. We had a thing called the ZGS Improvement Program because the ZGS didn't work very well when they first built it. So over half of the effort of at least the scientists and some of the engineers in the lab was aimed at that. We had other things started up like this cosmic ray experiment and so on.
That's at Mount Evans, right?
And Don Kirst got interested in building plasma devices and so on. But we went ahead and in their spare time, Ed and Charlie and Bill, I was busy doing other things. I was teaching too, and built this machine and on a shoestring, believe me. There's stuff in there, an original one that we used in those three models. We were taken out, put it, if it could be used, it was used. And but Ed also got in touch with, was contacted by a guy at Illinois, Jerry Kruger, and I had been a graduate student in his cyclotron laboratory very briefly, so I knew him. But he was on an NAS panel that basically said there ought to be a machine for doing far ultraviolet low energy X-ray research for synchrotron radiation. Now, synchrotron radiation research was being done at a number of places. There was at DAISY, they did use the synchrotron, and there was a strong group doing that, but it was as the synchrotron. They didn't have a storage ring. And there was a certain amount of disbelief that storage rings would work, you know, at that time. And the people at the Bureau of Standards,
Bob Madden?
Madden, yeah.
Yeah.
That was, I think it was M-A something.
M-A-D-D-E-N.
Yeah, they had a GE betatron that they had modified to a synchrotron, and they used that as a source of synchrotron radiation for some atomic physics research. So that was going on, and there was a French group, I know. Anyway, so we went ahead, and it was after Muro was dead, about a year, more than a year afterwards, before we could get the wherewithal to put the thing together and run it. And which is, as I say, everybody was pretty much doing this on their spare time. Although we did have a few people after we departed the UW. And so it ran, and it ran so well that we said, okay, let's get started. And these guys, Ed had worked together with three guys. There was Fred Brown.
We're going to be talking with
Urbana.
Him.
Urbana. Yeah, he's a nice guy. He might have forgotten about all that now.
No, he's pretty, our sense is that he's pretty sharp. I have been communicating with him.
Well, he's a smart guy.
He's still, he's still, you know.
A guy named Helmut Fritchie at Chicago.
He's one that I'm still trying to track down.
And so there was another guy, was it Heizu somebody? He was a Japanese fellow.
Fujita.
Fujita,
yeah, that's right. Those three guys, they all agreed to come and work on this thing, and so they did, and that's how it got started. And the only other thing was the initial funding. The at one moment, in order to finish it, we actually Harold Wittig probably did the most. He arranged to get a grant in my name for the lab. From ARPA,
right?
Which is, a defense agency,
right.
For this.
It was the Air Force.
They steered us to the Air Force. They said, "Go see those guys." The Science Foundation wouldn't look at us, and not the AEC either.
It's too bad Ed Rowe is not around. I remember being really impressed with after he started.
Well, Ed,
running things, I mean, he was fine technically, but I was impressed with his ability to manage the experimenters and pick out the ones that would do a good job.
It just fitted him perfectly. Mm-hmm. He did a super job. And there's just, you know, no question about it. I think the success of the place probably has a lot, mostly to do with that.
Yeah. Well, we have, the Smithsonian, you know, did a series of interviews with Ed and Charlie and
Roger
Fred Oddie. Brown and
Roger
Oddie and Cliff Olson, which we have the tapes that the Smithsonian did. So we do have Ed's take on
Did Smithsonian write it up?
They didn't write, I don't think it's ever been published, but they taped it, and we have copies of the tape, which we've now digitized, and, you know, when they took half of Tantalus back to Washington, it's in a Smithsonian warehouse somewhere.
The other thing you might want to know is, why is it separate from the lab?
And the physical separation, you mean?
You mean SRC?
Administrative separation.
Well, I was the one that actually separated SRC and PSL. In 1985, 86.
Okay, but the way the administrative separation came because when I was director, I could have said that this is just part of the lab, the lab's project, but I decided it was better to have it independent at some level. I named myself as the principal investigator, not the director of the lab, and that very specifically so that the place couldn't be somebody else come in and shut it down because it was bothersome or something like that. When I left, the Air Force said, well, who's going to be principal investigator? And I suggested Ed, and that worked.
Yeah. And then in 1986, I separated the two from the standpoint of the university into two separate parts because we had a director at PSL with Murray Thompson and it was hell. I mean,
Dad never got along with those guys.
And so it just really was clear that there were two separate missions. I mean, PSL
was
in charge back
at
and
the time,
yeah,
the
and so we finally I was finally able to get it.
Earlier.
20 years earlier.
I wondered exactly when that actually happened.
Yeah.
Because I wrote the charters for those two. I wrote two separate charters. And
Forson?
No, the dean of the graduate school.
Oh, Bob Bach.
Bach, sorry. Been a long time.
Yeah.
he was having all these places. He had the Space Sciences Center, and there was, you know, the engineering research.
Well, right now the graduate school has 18 centers like that, which SRC is one of them, where they're all interdisciplinary, so they don't really fit nicely in any academic department. So
the other thing that we did, which you will find very interesting, was that we had all these, you know, engineers and physicists to bring into the university system, not as faculty. And the university actually didn't have a way to do that. It only had one title, which was research assistant.
Research specialists, they were called, weren't they?
That was later.
But assistants were students.
No, they were anybody before that time.
Oh, okay.
So
because
we actually organized, together with some of the guys in the graduate school, organized these titles of scientists 1, 2, 3. You know, you have to promote people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so on. I remember Vern Sumi, who was the director of the
Space Sciences Lab,
he told me, boy, that's the greatest thing in the world. He says, I don't have to call these visitors research assistants.
He just died about a year ago. Not too long ago.
Anyway, that's another little bit of side history.
Yeah, see, I came in the late 70s.
Yeah,
and
right.
So I got involved and worked with Harold to transfer all the equipment from the Air Force to the National Science Foundation. So that was when I came on board, so I went through all of the Aladdin transition and stuff and did all of that.
The transition of getting
Aladdin on board.
Getting the equipment from AEC was really something. They took what they wanted, and we fought for the rest.
And then it was everything that had already been done before I came. But then the Air Force, it was the same situation. We had to get the Air Force all the stuff that was. I remember pouring over these pages and pages of equipment and university equipment numbers and all of this thing going through . And Harold and I did that. Harold was phasing out and I was coming in, so we would work together to get that done before he left.
Right. The other thing was that we tried to get funding to do accelerator research with that machine, and well, the AEC just wouldn't touch it, and they were just so unhappy that we were doing this that you couldn't believe. But and while well, wait, we're sorry, I'm losing the track here, but later, well, it was later on, I was thinking of this.
How long were you director?
Well, I was director of the lab for, what, 2 or 3 years, something like that, and then director of PSL for some year, four years, something like that, I can't remember.
Now, when did you go to Fermilab?
73. I went to Brookhaven in 70, because I wanted to start doing big colliders. We got some projects started there, but they petered out.
Okay.
So we got, when I went to Fermilab, we...
So from 67 to 70, you were director at PSL?
Oh, PSL, yeah.
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 Okay. And then did Harold Forsens come after you?
I think it was Harold was the next director, yeah.
Okay.
We did that or Murray Thompson, I can't remember.
No, Murray came
later. That was later, yeah.
Because Murray came after me, actually,
yeah.
Because Bob Borchers,
right.
I think Bob took Harold's... Forsen came after Harold Forsen, I think. And Bob was director out there. That was after the Sterling Hall bombing. And then Bob Bach was looking for something for Bob Borchers to do, and so convinced him to go out and be director of PSL. And Bob brought me out from the campus.
Oh, okay.
Bob Borchers did.
Yeah, I was out of it after 73. I didn't have much to do with him. And all that, after 70, rather. So everything that developed from after that.
I'd forgot that Harold Forsen was involved.
Yeah, he was director for
He was director for...
He spirited off Bob Beck and took him to... What was
that
it?
That took him out to... Yeah, the... out to Washington. To
right.
I can't think of the name of the
it's
company.
An oil company.
It'll come to me. I can't think of it right now.
Laser. It was laser. He was a... working on laser stuff.
Bob Beck was back 2 years ago, and
he'd
come back for a visit.
Yeah.
And also Glenn Henderson. Did you remember Glenn?
Glenn?
Okay.
Yeah, sure,
Glenn was is out there in the same area, I think, in Washington
right?
State. Yeah, they're both still out.
He didn't leave then. He did all the welding.
No, he came late. He left later, I think.
He did all the welding on he and Ed Kennedy on the toroidal monopole. And he did all the ultra high vacuum welding we did in the lab. So
you have some other questions for that early period?
Charlie Pruitt told me that you would be the one to talk to about it. Basically, I familiarized myself with everything that Tantalus was and what I'm really interested in and what it wasn't. And my main question was about the 50 MeV machine, the FFAG, and how it transitioned from the idea of being a positron electron collider to storage ring. I was wondering if you could just talk about that phase of the FFAG.
Well, I think Ed somehow thought he could get enough positrons, although he never convinced me that he could make any collider. But the facts were that nobody was going to pay for that. And you could get somebody to support the thing for synchrotron radiation, so that was the end of the positron.
Okay.
Thank heavens, because I think it would have been a complete disaster. I just don't think, you know, you look at successful labs that make positrons for colliders, they have a lot better source than the 50 MeV machine for that.
What would have been the source?
Well, it was a two-way machine, so you could have had electron-electron.
It wasn't a two-way machine when we did all this. It was a one-way machine.
Yeah.
But we had extracted beam from it also,
mm-hmm.
which it just died on the vine because the real reason was that no one would pay for it, and there's the second reason is it probably wouldn't have worked. I don't think there was enough intensity. To actually, you would have had to build a little storage ring, and there's not enough radiation damping to to accumulate, it would have been, you know, a mess.
Yeah. What would have been the source for the positrons?
Well, they fit the MEV machine.
But how, where, how would they be made?
You hit a target, that's how you make positrons. And then you accelerate them, so you know, usually in these things you hit, if you stick an electron beam into you know, three or four radiation lengths of material, then what comes out is a spectrum of positrons, and the number depends just basically on how much beam energy you put into it. And we just didn't have enough beam energy to get enough positrons, and the energy was too low. Well, then you want to accumulate these electrons at least at, you know, around a, well, it would have been at least 200 MeV, but you don't get any positrons, you know. So, anyway, I've never seen a calculation that Ed did on that either, so.
Maybe there somewhere, maybe we'll come across
Indeed.
It.
Maybe. Yeah. But, you know, that, but it didn't matter. You couldn't have sold it on that score anyway. Although, I think it was, there might have been one of those narrow resonances, the rho or the omega, that might have been there. Incidentally, the other thing I didn't tell you is that at Orsay, they went ahead and built one of the first electron positron colliders using this stuff that I did. And that school was called ACO, A-C-O. And that was, they did a lot of nice physics for that. But they had money. I mean, they had one or two GeV Linac, electron Linac, that they could make all kinds of positrons. And you just couldn't compete with that kind of thing. And Slack had the big Linac, so.
It just seems, it's hard to get things started in the Midwest. Seemed like if you had to be on one coast or the other in order.
Well, that was the problem with Nero, because most of the money went to the two coasts. That was the whole problem there. Any other questions about?
What about the three different models? What was the idea with them, with the Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin?
Well, Keith can tell you. He's the inventor of at least one of them.
Well, there were different varieties of FFAG. The original idea was just a straightforward device with magnets alternating in direction so as to get an alternating gradient focusing so that was the Michigan model. The first one was built. And then Don Kerst invented spiral sector focusing, where you could get the alternating gradient without having reversed fields, so it was much smaller. With a radial sector machine, the total circumference was about five times the circumference of a circle of radius of curvature in the magnet. We call that the circumference factor. And in a spiral sector machine, it was about two, wasn't it, the circumference factor? Yeah.
Yes, it would be two.
In fact, it was mainly the fact that you had all the magnets had the field in the right direction, but you had about equal spaces in between that were where there wasn't any magnet, so you ended up having a total circumference about twice what you would. And so that looked to have advantages, and so then that was the spiral sector model, or we also named them after the place that
that one was the Illinois.
Built the parts, yeah.
That's what I was going to ask, because I didn't know where the names came from. So
hmm?
I didn't know where the names had, why they were named the way they were named. It's because the majority of the work was done by.
Well, yeah, the radio sector model was built by Jones and Terwilliger at Michigan.
And then the radio, the spiral sector model was largely built at Illinois. Of course, Purdue did the magnets really were for both of those, but had Bob Haxby and the. But they moved it when the lab got formed in '56. The whole thing was moved to the lab. So
it was never assembled in Illinois, was it?
No.
Yeah.
But this, you know, the, all of the pieces and parts were.
Yeah.
Most of them, not all of them. We did some of them here, but that was the origin. It was Don Kirst. So when he came as technical director, he of course brought that with him.
And then Okawa invented the two-way machine. And so we built the 50 MeV model for them.
And then you were part of that, building that model? That was,
well, I didn't have anything to do with building it, but I was in the group.
Okay. Who else was in that group?
Everybody.
Oh, everybody.
The whole group,
oh,
yeah.
The whole group, okay.
I remember being impressed with the radio sector model and also the spiral sector model that seemed to me they were the first machines I knew of that ran when they were first turned on. I mean, most machines you
got to tweak them,
put it together, and then you fiddle it until you get everything working right. But they were designed. They were probably the first machines that were designed almost completely numerically with computers from the beginning.
Absolutely.
And so. We knew what the magnetic fields were going to be, and we knew what the orbits were going to be, and we assembled it and turned it on, and there was the beam.
That's pretty amazing, actually.
Yeah, it worked the very first time. But they were very conservative parameters compared to the kinds of things we wanted to build later. I'm going to get out some things. And do you have a flash drive?
Not with me.
Oh,
have a what?
Flash drive. No, a memory stick.
It's too bad. We should have brought one.
I didn't think of that.
I've got one, but it's full already, I think. Pretty much full.
Can we put it on a CD?
Yeah.
I'll show you some of the stuff. I mean,
I got some CDs.
Yeah, this doesn't always do all that well. Well, I think it's from mine. I don't know.